This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and thank you very much for downloading the Scotland Outdoors podcast. I'm Mark Stephen, coming to you today from my home in Aberdeenshire. I don't know if you can hear in the background there, but there's sparrows cheeping away. If you listen very carefully, you could hear skylarks. And if you listen really, really carefully, you could hear chomping noises in the background. If I just turn round, there's three horses in the field just behind me. There's a grey called Polo, who's filthy. There's a dark bay called Mouse, that belongs to my wife. Very appropriately named Mouse, quite timid. And somewhere behind the trees there, there's a mad ginger mare called Maggie, who is quite possibly the grumpiest horse on the planet. We live with horses all the time. But with me in this edition, another person well acquainted with cuddies, Helen Needham.
Hello there. Well, I'm sitting in my home office here on my family farm. And when I look out the window, in fact, every day when I'm working away here, I can see my mother's Welsh ponies in the field. And I can see them just out. And the colours at this time of year, because they're chestnut, one's liver chestnut and the other one's chestnut. You call them ginger. Horsey people call them chestnuts, Mark. Against that grass, you know, that fresh grass, because there's been quite a bit of rain and it's a bit drizzly today. It's just beautiful, and they just look fabulous in their summer coats.
Yeah, I don't pretend to be particularly horsey myself. As I always say to folk, my responsibility is finance and sanitation.
You know, so pay for very important.
Pay for it to go in one end and then pick it up when it falls out the other. But I understand that there's a very special relationship between horses and riders, and the natural environment, you know, the way they can access the natural environment is really the focus of our podcast today. Our guest is a lady who spent a considerable amount of time with a Highland pony, Ross, when she rode from the southern tip of Barra right the way up to the Callanish Stone Circle on Lewis in what was a life-changing journey. Leonie Charlton is the author of a book called Marham. It's a beautiful book which describes that adventure, and she joins us from her home in Glen Lonan in Argyll. Good morning to you, Leonie.
Good morning, Mark and Helen.
You're actually on a hill farm there too, so just describe it to us. What's it like?
Yeah, so we're on a hill farm in Glen Lonan, which runs southwest from Tynholt towards the sea. It's a rough hill farm, so we've got forested hillsides with ancient oak and birch and hazel woods with red squirrels, and we've got open hill. We're very lucky, we've got golden eagles here and hen harriers and lots of good rough grazing for ponies. I'm looking out the window and I'm seeing black-faced sheep and the pony herd. So there's six horses here. They're looking very sleek it in the rain, like Helen was saying.
Quite well, I said ours are just looking filthy, to be honest. We were recommended your book by a listener to our radio programme at BBC Radio Scotland, Out of Doors. So thank you very much to Renate Powell, who pointed us in your direction. Before we go on to the journey itself, for folk who don't know, tell us a bit about Highland ponies.
That's a huge subject, and I'm by no means an expert, but my Highland pony, Ross, is a rum Highland, and it's quite a unique strain that was developed on the island of Rum to take deer carcasses off the hill. But not only that, they're a very versatile breed. They would carry seaweed and do all the farm work and pull things. They're very beautiful. They've got rare colour combinations like fox dun and silver dun.
You describe in your book Or rather, you quote in a book a description from Samuel Johnson in his journey to the Western Isles. And he describes them as very small, but of a breed eminent for beauty. And what colour's Ross?
Eminent for beauty. So Ross, his passport says dappled chocolate, which is very exotic. So he's...
I want a passport like that.
Wouldn't that be lovely? So he's dark, and in the summer he gets these beautiful dapples, and his mane and tail have got blonde, very fair highlights. And the breed is now not that small. So, 200 years ago, it would have been a much smaller pony type. But Ross is a respectable 14-1, and he's very well built.
The colours you're describing are actually very unusual in the horse world. Where are they thought to come from?
Well, myth has it that ships of the Spanish Armada, when they sank off the west coast, Spanish stallions swam ashore and bred with the native ponies and brought a bit of exotic blood in. That's the myth, and I like to think it's true.
Well, we'll keep on punting that myth.
Yeah.
That's the first time I've heard that. That's brilliant. I think that'll be a dinner party story when we all start sitting around tables together again.
Imagine that.
Yeah. You decided to ride from the southern tip of the island of Barra up through the Uis, Harris and Lewis with your friend Shuna and her Highland pony Chief. That's become quite a well-trodden route in recent years, particularly for cyclists doing the Hebridean Way. What made you two decide to do this on horseback and rough it with the tents?
A good question. I got to know Shuna when I needed help training Ross 17 years ago. And since then, we've done a lot of long trips together with ponies. And as I'm sure you can imagine, it's not everybody you could do a trip like that with. So we've developed this fabulously strong foundation, and we've just been getting more and more ambitious in our travels. Well, ambitious, that's not quite the word, but we felt we'd start with a few days, and then it became a week, and then 10 days, and then we had this thought of, imagine being away for 3 weeks. And I have a good friend who had Icelandic ponies on the Isle of Tyree for many years, and she's a very experienced long-distance rider. And she said one day that she'd always had a dream of riding up through the Outer Hebrides, and that sowed a seed, and it just never went away. And 2017, it came together in a really organic, easy way. It was the year to do it.
You're saying it's an easy way, but it can't possibly have been an easy way. It's a logistical nightmare. Because I mean, you've got to transport the horses onto the islands in the first place and then move them from island to island.
Absolutely, Mark. The trip itself was not without difficulty, but it coming together and making the time, that all happened really, really easily. But yeah, huge logistics to work out. And very, very, we were very reliant on the kindness of strangers, effectively.
That's actually a lovely circumstance to be in, because it's kind of enforced humility. And I've always found that the world is incredibly full of kindness.
Yeah, Mark, it's amazing you say that word, humility. I was lying in bed last night thinking about this chat today and, why travel and why do these things? And humility is a massive part of it. Because I think I read somewhere that the etymological roots of humility is of the ground.
Yeah, humus. Yes.
And it's very, very humbling. You don't have your usual props. You don't have your usual friends and house and all of that. You put yourself in a very vulnerable position, and it's very freeing and it's very rewarding. And not that it's always easy, but through difficulty, we learn, don't we?
And actually, you ended up meeting so many wonderful people as a result of that. And I know
absolutely.
From my own experience travelling, I found travelling in far-off places, particularly with a young family, you just open yourself up to new experiences because people want to connect with you. So in the same way with you being with the ponies, people really were drawn to you.
Absolutely. I think it is. There's something about people's response to horses and ponies in general is incredible, especially, I must say, especially out there in the Outer Isles. I really saw that. And I suppose that's because until very recently, horses were the mainstay of life. And it's still in living memory, the importance of the horse and that knowledge and understanding. So people are very friendly towards people, but having the ponies there alongside, yeah, people open up in a different way.
Just explain the logistics behind it, you know, how you actually did it. Because, you know, as I said, you've got to use, you know, a pickup truck and a trailer to get them up the island in the first place. But how do you join the dots?
Lots of talking to people, looking at the diary, looking at ferry timetables, being flexible and thinking ahead. I have to say my riding partner Shuna did the lion's share of that on this trip. It's not always like that. On other trips I've done a lot, but she was absolutely magnificent on this trip and set it up beautifully. But you, within it all, you need an element of flexibility because the ferries might not go because of the weather, etc., etc. And actually, that was an element we both really enjoyed. So with other trips, it's been much more organised. Like, we've known exactly where we'll be every night and food drop-offs and all of that on the mainland. Because we had the pickup and trailer, we were able to be a wee bit more flexible. And that brought a whole different dimension to the trip.
But you're still relying on, at some stage, getting to the far end sometimes. One of you holds both ponies and the other one has to hitchhike back to where the pickup and the trailer actually was.
Yeah, hitchhiking was not the joyous experience I'd imagined it would be. It was really hard work. Of course, when you're hitching, you don't have the ponies with you. So, and maybe we looked a bit grubby and who knows. But do you know, people stepped up. People were so kind. And in the end, we didn't really have to do a lot of hitching. People gave us lifts. It worked well. It was a good system. And there's something, yeah, really powerful about being in that place of uncertainty. You can really live in the moment then. You don't have to be at a certain place at a certain time. You can respond to your environment in a different way. And that wiring in our heads of everyday life finds new routes.
Oh, that sounds so liberating. I'm actually getting a touch of excitement thinking of that feeling where it doesn't matter what the time of the day is. And I'm thinking about some of the descriptions you have of riding into the dark, basically. You just keep going, and it doesn't matter, does it? It's just to get to somewhere.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. And of course, there isn't a great deal of dark at that time of year. But it doesn't matter if it's 11 o'clock at night, unless you're turning up at a hostel and people are a bit grumpy.
There's always grumpy people at hostels, aren't there?
Yeah, the whole hostel thing, that's another fascinating experience.
Yeah, it's difficult because the etiquette of hostels seems to have changed over the years, and you are almost guaranteed to do something wrong. You don't mean to, it just happens.
Yeah, yes! That is amazing you say that, and you immediately sort of put on a guilty conscience when you walk in the door. It's really weird. I'm not sure it's my most favourite thing. However, it is totally fascinating.
I have a complaint to make, by the way, because I said I really enjoyed your book, but I've managed to go all the way through lockdown so far without getting sort of itchy feet, without thinking, oh, I wish I could actually visit there and what have you. And then you started talking about the Hebrides, and I know them reasonably well. For folk who haven't been there, describe them. What are they like?
Intoxicating, very, very changeable. Every minute of every day is different. The light, I think the light is what most captivates me. There's so much sky and so much horizon and nuance in the light. And there's a lot of air and a lot of salt, and quite often there's a lot of wind, and it's very, very invigorating.
You met that woman out, and she said, I've been here for whatever it was, 5-6 days, and I've been shattered by the wind. I knew exactly what she meant by that.
Yeah, that wind. And of course, then you've got the marram grass holding it all together.
Because it is, a lot of the coastline is actually made up of shell sand. So, you know, you've got the maca that grows in that. So it's just a riot, a profusion, an unbelievable embarrassment of riches when it comes to wildflowers. It's glorious when it's in season. Barra, the only airport in the UK where the plane actually lands on the beach.
It's so romantic, isn't it? It's so elemental. This plane comes in, the tide goes out, the plane comes in, tiny little plane. And in fact, the whole of the Outer Hebrides, it feels remote, as in you're on the edge of something, and yet you're within a community that is so connected.
There's a lovely passage that we'd love you to read that describes a burial ground at Borv Point on Barra, and for me, this just encapsulates the feeling of what it's like being in a place like that so exquisitely.
We'd got to Barra, the beginning of our trip. We'd had our first night of camping. We'd barely slept. It was so cold. We set off down a track to this graveyard. We got off and led the ponies to a gate on the far side of the burial ground. A sign told us it was a Commonwealth graveyard, that casualties from both the First and Second World Wars were buried here. We took it in turns to hold the ponies while the other wandered amongst the stones, listening, touching, reading the lettered, dated summations of lives, short-lived and long-lived, were being taken over by lichens, some like smooth spillages of cream, others sage-green and wiry. The air was strung with the oscillating calls of curlews, and lapwings flung themselves in somersaults against the wind. This place of remembrance was a sanctuary for birds. I felt a sense of privilege to be there that was almost too much to bear. We walked in silence towards the tip of the point, the carved gravestones replaced by body-sized rocks left by the sea or glaciers, or maybe both. A curlew whistled an alarm and we stopped. The sky was full of birds watching over their nests. We had a sense of trespassing on hallowed ground. The bird calls escalated, echoing our own sense of wonder. As we retreated, a slender head and neck peered at us from above a rock. There was something strangely adolescent about this bird as it wheeled up, all awkward elegance before the sky stole it. Later, the bird book told us it was a godwit.
From Barra to South Uist, you took a ferry to Eriski. Now, that in itself has got its own breed of ponies. And it's an island that was once famous for its horses, and one particular character, a silent weaver, Angus McPhee. Tell me about him.
So, Shuna introduced me to Angus McPhee through Roger Hutchinson's beautiful book, The Silent Weaver. He set off to the Second World War in 1939 with his fine gelding, and there's a beautiful picture of him in the book. He went from Uist to the unimaginable horrors, and he came back damaged. And he spent 50 years at Craigdonane Psychiatric Hospital up in Inverness, and eventually in his 80s came back to Uist. He spent the rest of his life making things, weaving things out of flowers and leaves and grass. He made shoes and bags and bridles and halters and nose bags for ponies. One of the reasons we know about him and is because there was a nurse who took particular interest in him and saved some of these beautiful creations of his. I think he never spoke again. Although when we met his nephew on Uist, he said he did used to speak, he would speak, and he'd be speaking to people behind his shoulder, and he'd be having a real laugh with them, but they weren't people that he could see.
It's just such a remarkable story because, you know, probably the last soldiers in the British Army ever to ride to war. You know, these guys were heading off for the Lovett Scouts, and, you know, and they had these horses beautifully turned out, heading for the ferry to go off to war.
Yeah, they were the last horse soldiers in the British Army. They were heading in with these the best of their horses. They were heading into industrial war. It's absolutely horrific. So I don't know if any of the horses made it back, and so many of the men didn't, and those who did were so damaged. But yeah, that picture of these upstanding young men riding down South Uist on their beautifully, as you say, beautifully turned out horses onto the boat at Loch Boisdell, taking the best away with them.
And one of the things you said there too, that, you know, he would make horse bridles. That's what they did on Eriskay.
They were in the army with these marram grass bridles. We'd hoped to have... Yeah. Marram grass bridles for that trip, but that's something to do. We'll go in our marram grass bridles.
Throughout the journey, there's a clear sense of you connecting with the past. So there's the historical past of the island, like the story of Angus McPhee, but also your own past and the particular relationship with your mother, who had died a few years previously. And I really connected to the fact that you're very honest about that it wasn't an easy or a comfortable relationship. And that's a narrative thread throughout the book. It's something you work through as the journey progresses. What do you think it is about journeying in particular that lends itself to this kind of emotional exploration?
Well, there's something about setting out on a journey that renews you. You're open and you're new, and there are all sorts of possibilities for leaving stuff behind and seeing yourself in a much more honest way. When I was on that journey, I saw my mum in a whole new way. I found her in a whole new way. In a way, I couldn't have done that anywhere else. I couldn't have done that by being at home. And I'd tried all sorts of things to feel better about our relationship and about her death. And it just wasn't working. I felt like it was the pain was getting more and more crippling. And setting out on that journey and leaving beads for her in these places, I was able to have a whole new conversation with myself, and I felt with her, which I'm very thankful for.
Maybe you could explain the beads so that people could understand that.
Yeah, so my mum was a jeweller. She was an intrepid traveller. So she was brave. I'm not a brave traveller. She went all over the world, did a lot of solo travel, very brave, and she had this passion for people, and she had a passion for beads. So she had this exquisite bead collection. And it was never part of the trip to leave beads for mum, but a few weeks before I went, I was talking to a very good friend of mine, a Spanish friend, and her mum had died at a similar time, and she said that she'd done a ritual. I don't know what she'd done, but she'd done something with objects, and it really helped her let go of her mum. And it got me thinking, I haven't tried that. I've done all this head stuff and thinking and trying to let go and everything, but I haven't actually done a physical act for mum. And so that's what it was. I collected a little purse of her beads, and every day I left beads for her in wherever I was moved to. And she herself loved the Outer Hebrides. We'd never been there together, but she loved it out there. I felt very close to her doing that. This is day 11, and we're on North Uist, and we ride over the committee road to the tidal island of Valais, which is an extraordinary, extraordinary place. So this is where we camped that night. The tent was up, mats inflated, sleeping bags laid out. We'd eaten delicious soup made with noodles and fish, Tabasco and miso. We put more wood on the fire, wood that we'd collected back at the steadings that had been discarded when they re-roofed the sheds. I picked up the half bottle of Jura Superstition and poured another peaty dram. The northwesterly breeze lifted ash and smoke from the fire. Gulls called as they fed off the sea, coming in over the warm sand. In the furthest distance, we could see St. Kilda, a small cone of mauve enticing on the horizon. The tide was coming closer. Waves slapped noisily against the skerries. I rubbed my hands, still damp and chilled from when I'd gone down to the sea to wash the cooking pots. The water had felt deceptively warm in comparison to the dropping air temperature. The sun was sinking in an orange glow behind slivers of cloud. Seagulls began to drop down onto the shore, crying their bedtime banter. "It's after 10, said Shuna. "Should we walk out to the point to watch the last of the sunset?" Across the Macca, primroses glowed like lemony stars. As we headed over the rocks to the point, we disturbed a lone goose, who took off and landed splashily on the sea. A seal rolled roundly alongside him. We sat down, rocks apart, lost in our own thoughts. I brushed my hand across the sea pinks next to me, petals rizzler dry against my palm. On the turning tide, the gull chatter quietened. The sun burned a dent in the sea and slowly dropped into it. Walking back to the tent, our faces and fingers stiff with cold, three fairy terns flew by, their tails ribboning through the plaited sundown sky.
See the problem, Helen? Now you just want to go to the Western Isles.
Oh, tell me about it. Reading that book in lockdown, I just
it's
got
murder.
The yearn big time.
You obviously had a difficult relationship with your mother, but
yeah,
she and your father actually really gave you a love of the natural world.
Massively. I feel hugely grateful to them both. My love of the natural world is the foundation of my life. Well, my father's alive. He's an expert on so many things. Birds are his main passion, I would say. And then Mum loved creepy crawlies, insects, spiders, anything with wings and scales and stings. That was her main passion. And horses, of course.
Yeah, the kids weren't allowed to call her Granny.
No, that was far too normal. She resisted normality. She was called Lolo, which is a giant African centipede. So she was Lolo, still is Lolo. That was Mum, nothing normal and nothing straightforward and amazing.
Let's jump to Harris now, which is a very different environment from watery North Uist, which comes before it.
Yeah.
It's a dramatic place, Harris. You've got the mountains and then you've got these gorgeous beaches that have become world famous. And you and Shuna took the decision, shall we say, to go off-piste with your route and head right into the hills to reach Lewis, which was pretty challenging.
Yeah.
Can you describe that route and the sort of decision-making process there?
I was meant to have done the route research for this bit of the trip. And
right.
I'd sort of left it to fate, for want of a better way of explaining it. Shuna and I had often talked about doing a trip where we were a bit more fluid, where we'd just talk to people and the next day would be informed by conversations. Of course, it is much more complicated when you've got horses rather than just being on foot. But anyway, we had a few very inspiring conversations about a place called Kinloch Resort. It took on mythical proportions in our imaginations, and we decided to go for it. And we knew it would be a challenge. We didn't know anyone who'd gone in with horses. Quite a bit of it's unmarked. There are no tracks on the map. Having spoken to a couple of people, we thought we'd give it a go. It was a very challenging day to get into Kinloch Resort, and there are many moments looking back when we could have turned back. And this incredible thing happens. You really have to bear in mind that, yes, we knew we could turn back, but you get bewitched by a place, you get bewitched by a route, and we knew where we wanted to go, and we just felt that we could do it, and we kept going and kept going to a point of no return, really.
That's the thing, you just think, just round the next corner, just round the next corner. You actually did find a wonderful place to stay, and this is a real high point, and I wonder if you could do a reading for us again.
Kinloch Resort, nobody lives there, there's no road in, there are lots of old shealings and black house ruins, and then there are two what they call white houses, one on each side of the bay, and I believe I'm right in saying that one's in Lewis, one's in Harris, and these have roofs and windows. And we were exploring, and earlier on I'd walked past one, and there was a hand-painted sign that said, "Welcome to the last resort, you will never leave." And I just took a photo, I thought it was hilarious. Anyway, it would come back to haunt us. So this is us, we've found somewhere to camp, and we're super delighted. "This is the life," I said, rubbing my bare feet, which were slowly warming now they were rid of the sodden socks and boots. Just then the sea eagle did another flyby, leaving a startle of bird calls in its astronomical wake. It seemed it was us she had in her inquisitive sights, though, not dinner. Then we saw the rainbow, a broad, bright thumbs up of a rainbow, over towards where we hoped to pick up the postal track the next day. We were still spellbound when we lay down inside the tent on the mossy footprint of a black house. We fell asleep quickly, blissfully unaware of how much a place can change in just 24 hours, or that we'd be forced to stay another night out there in the house with the stone-filled windows. That second night, the words, "Welcome to the last resort, you will never leave," would take on a whole other meaning.
My wife hasn't had a chance to read your book yet, but I'm going to give it to her, but I'm fairly certain I know what her reaction's going to be when she gets to this next bit, because it happened to her.
Oh, did it?
Many years ago on the slopes of Benahee, it just went wrong, and the horse was kind of half stuck underneath a fir tree too. Explain how things went badly wrong the next day. I mean, really quite scarily wrong the next day.
They went really scarily wrong, yeah. So we knew of this postal route out to the north, and this was what we'd set our hopes on. Getting out that way. We had had a few frights the day before, and we realised this was very, very, very serious peat country. So we set off on foot to check the route, and there was this amazing stretch of 50 yards of a proper track that obviously had been hand-built, goodness knows when, and then it just stopped, and then it's peat hags. And we set off, and we felt wrongly that we would be able to pick our way across. Like, we have both got extensive experience with peat, but this was a whole different league. So we set off with the ponies, very cautiously at leading them, and my pony Ross went into a peat hag. We had to dig him out, and it was absolutely terrifying. And I, the whole time I was writing the book, I was dreading getting to day 19. And I didn't know how I'd be able to write it. But we got him out. And it was very touch and go. And we were so far away from, would it have been a 7-8 hour walk out? We had no phone signal, nothing. So the whole time he was in this peat bog, getting deeper and deeper and more exhausted. You know, our minds were thinking, well, how on earth are we going to get help? It was a very, very stressful experience.
See, that's the kind of situation where the emotional bond you have with a horse, because it's not a pet, you know, it's a partnership, that starts to work against you, because you understandably, it's like watching a child. You're panicking.
I felt pretty hopeless. I was so emotionally involved. The sheer horror of seeing my beloved pony in that predicament, it was like I couldn't quite believe what I was seeing. I mean, we have got into peat bogs before, but the scale of this, it was like his tail was spread out across this peat. And Shuna was completely magnificent. She stepped in, she remembered all the tricks. We've spoken to people over the years about how to get ponies out of peat bogs. It's the sort of conversations you have with other pony owners. And we tried everything. And she, thankfully, remembered it enough and we got him out. But, you know, by the end of it, we were covered in blood and peat and we were ashen. And complete wrecks. And then these, you know, Ross just covered in peat and then gave himself a wee shake and started grazing. Absolutely amazing. But he had known that things were very, very serious. I'll never forget the look in his eye.
See, it's interesting because you recount many, many examples of kindness, of friendliness, of welcome. And, you know, this is probably the lowest point in your entire trip, and this is the one point where you really, really needed help and you didn't get it, you know, from other people.
Yeah, it was so spooky. To this day, I can't quite get my head around it. So we made it back to the cottage and we were clearly going to stay another night. There was no way we were going anywhere. We had to have a serious rethink. We were also running out of food. And we knew bad weather was coming in. We were recovering. I think we were both in severe shock. And we saw this boat. I thought I was hallucinating. This grey, it was like battleship grey boat come into the bay. And with men and binoculars. And my first instinct was, oh, thank God. There's some people. This is wonderful. So we sort of clattered across the bay with the ponies towards these people, and yeah, there was one man who was lovely. He couldn't believe the ponies were there, and I think he's a stalker and he really liked working with ponies and he was excited to talk about them. But very quickly we realized we were not welcome. Help was not forthcoming. Not that I mean, we were in such shock, we probably weren't saying very much, but I do remember saying, please, can you look at a map with us? It was just horrible. It was like shutters came down, and they were not for helping. They were definitely not for helping.
Whoever the alpha male was in that group, you know, I mean, whoever was the boss man in charge or whatever, you know, this stalker is looking at the maps and trying to give you information as to how to get you out of the area.
He was so lovely. I think about that man often, and we did manage to get a moment with him before they went, and I said, please, will you look at a map? But meanwhile, he's being whistled to get back on the boat.
That's what I was going to refer to, because that's chilling, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's almost like a dog whistle. Come here, don't talk to him.
That's exactly what it was like. And he looked deeply uncomfortable, and he said, look, you are basically in the shit here, but you could try this. And he pointed it on the map, and then he was gone. And, you know, I thank you, because that's how we got out. That's how we got out. It was horrific getting out. That's another story. But we managed it. And it was a very, very interesting experience, because you are dependent. And then when you come across, I would say it was hostility. It's humbling in a whole other way. That was a life-changing experience. I've done some work with gypsy travellers, and they have a lot of stories, you know, being moved on and not being well received. And after that experience, I think I have an inkling of what that would feel like and how terrifying it is not to be well received. Yeah. Life-changing.
And actually, that was, you had a really terrible night sleeping there as well, which was a low point. But yeah, actually, I mean, it brought you to a new understanding.
Yeah, it was a dark night of the soul. That's what it was. I didn't sleep. So when the guys on the boat left, I sat there and I turned to Shuna and said, "Oh, they must think we are so stupid." Or I said something self-deprecating like that. And I'll never forget her burning gaze. And she said, "We are in real trouble. Why are you giving a damn about what anyone else thinks?" And that was such a wake-up call for me. It's like, oh, wow, yeah, here we are in trouble. And I'm worrying about what other people are thinking. That is bonkers. So we ended up effectively breaking into a bothy because the awful weather was coming. We didn't have to break anything, but we took all the stones away and opened a door. And we went into this house and slept in there, except we didn't sleep because it was one of the spookiest nights I've ever had in my life on so many levels. We couldn't get warm. The camp beds that we'd found were full of fleas, so they were biting. I had the flea bites for months and months afterwards. We had this sense of horrible weather coming in. I think I asked God for help. I certainly asked something else for help that night. I'm not want to pray to praying, and it was a very, very long night, and I do believe that it changed me forever.
What was, you said it was spooky. I mean, you slept in other, you know, ruined buildings in the past. What about that one particularly? What was wrong with it?
I just had this sense of presence that was deeply unhappy. The whole of my back was prickling and cold, and I was overwhelmed with a sense of sadness. Some places do that. I think it was a combination of foreboding, a feeling of severe foreboding about what we had ahead of us the next day, fear and shock, and I do believe there was a sadness in that place.
Yeah, the older I've got, the more I tend to listen to my instincts and that kind of thing. You know, because, you know, I'm not a great believer either way, but, you know, it's what harm in listening? We've talked to lots of people during lockdown about how the pace of life has altered for many of us in a really positive way, especially when it comes to connecting with the natural environment. And, you know, that must be very, very true when you're covering ground on horseback.
Absolutely. That's one of the most precious things for me. I'm not a big one for big mileage or summits or ticking anything off. I just like to travel slowly, and the slower the better. And being with the ponies, they're so finely tuned to the environment. It's like you get a wee loan of their senses. And it's a huge privilege because they pick up on so much. And when you spend long days with them, you become a little bit hoarse. And you catch thoughts and you see things ever so slightly differently. And the only other time I felt such presence and steadiness of pace has been during lockdown.
Interesting.
And in many ways I am grieving the end, the roads getting busy and the diary filling, and I think there's huge benefits from living slower. Being slower.
I think I know what your answer is going to be to this, but, you know, if I were to say to you just now, you can pick anywhere in the world, you know, the most gorgeous earthly paradise, and you can jump in a plane in an hour's time and go, what would your reaction be?
In this moment, I'll stay right here.
Leonie, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. I said I love the book. It's just a lovely exploration of a part of the world that I now yearn for terribly. Leonie Charlton's book Marum is out now. It's published by Sandstone Press. If there's anybody that you think we should be talking to, get in touch and tell us who you'd like to hear on this podcast. You can email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. From myself, Mark Stephen, Helen Needham, and of course Leonie Charlton, thanks for listening.